Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Ayin Tzayin and Amud Aleph, 8 lines down. Gemara says, Hahu nishbar etzem, in an instance where the bone had broken, v'yatzah l'chutz, and it is penetrating out of the skin and the flesh. We know from yesterday's daf that the broken bone, if it's covered rubo or basar, then it's fine. And rubo, we said, has to be robo vyo and rob hekefo. But here, the bone is penetrating out. And it has a small piece of it that broke away from the main bone. So, as opposed to before, where we have the bone that is whole, it's just cracked, and then it's covered by the roba or and roba basar. Over here, you have an instance where not only is it broken, but a piece of it detached from the bone and then fell away from the bone. The word kortita, as Rashi says, comes from like koret livona, which means a small piece. A small measure of the bone cracked away from it. Yet, it's still a situation in which basar ba'or chufim et rubo. It still has the qualifications that you would otherwise need. And the way that Rashi seems to describe it over here, it's the miut of the bone that extended, that cracked away, and that fell away from it. But otherwise, it's still covered, and it should qualify. Ata lekamei d'Abaye. So he brought the case before Abaye. Sheya talata rigle. He held on to it for 3 regalim. Rashi notes over here, on the regal, they used to gather together in Pumpadita to learn Torah, so a lot of chachamim came. So Abaye held it in order to counsel with those people that came to see if he could come to a conclusion or figure out what to paskin over here. Amalei Ravada bar Matno, Zil kamei d'Rava, Breid Rav Yosef bar Chamo. So go to Rava, the son of Rav Yosef Bar Chama, who is the famous Rava, the peer of Abaye, the Harifa Sakine. He's got a sharp knife. Rashi over here says that's just a euphemism for the fact that he's sharp as Svara, and he can figure these things out. You could see it as Harifa Sakine, that he is a matir in general with regards to these things of trefot, that he's more makil, or he's able to give sak. Or Harifa Sekineh might be exactly that. He can make decisions. He doesn't waver, he doesn't waffle on these issues, he makes decisions. Ata lekamei, so they brought the case before Rava. Amar michtei nishbar etzem v'yatzah l'chutz. The case that we're speaking about in our Mishnah where the bone is broken and has penetrated out of the flesh. It's none. We already have a Mishnah or Tanya. We had a Braita yesterday. It really depends on whether you think the Braita is explaining the Mishnah like Rashi. Or if you think, according to the Rashbo, that the Braita and the Mishnah are speaking about different cases, so then you'd have either Tznan or Tanya over here. Mali nafal, mali ite. What does it make a difference if a piece of the bone is broken away or if it is intact? Meaning that the only question that is addressed by the Mishnah or the Braita is im chofim oto rova basar. If there is basar over the rova of it, that's determinant over here. It's not about the shape of the bone. It's not about whether the bone's cracked away. It's simply whether the bone is protected and sealed in place. And if you have that, it should be fine. Given that the exposure of the miut itself is not problematic, so then why should any piece missing from that miut also be problematic? The Rava was willing to be matir over here in this case, saying that the fact that the bone broke away is not so relevant. The Balamor, on the other hand, unlike Rashi, says that the case here is where the bone broke, and the robe of the bone is actually exposed. You don't have the orbasar chufim et rubo. It's exposed, but then a piece of the bone breaks away. And that piece of the bone breaking away then makes it that it's chufim et rubo. The broken bone is actually what facilitates that the robe is there. And then when Rava comes to say, Mali, why does it make a difference if the bone's there or not there? That's actually the chumrah. And he's saying that we would not accept it as being chufim rubo, because it doesn't matter that the bone was there or not there, the bone was already exposed and did not have rova basar and a or covering it. And just because it broke now and that facilitates it being covered by rove, that doesn't change the fact that originally it was in a position where it wasn't covered by rove, and therefore it is a trefa. So that's the way that the Balamor learns it, that Ashpa brings both opinions down, and in the end says, ain't nafkamina. There's no nafkamina because the cases are different. Rashi is a case where the minority of the bone was exposed, and then a piece cracked away, and there Rashi says it's mutar. The Balamor is talking about a case where a majority of the bone was exposed, and then it cracked away. And he says the truth is that both of them could be true. They're not mutually exclusive positions, and therefore, the halacha, whether it's the position of Rashi or the Baal HaMor, both of them can be true. So Amale Ravina the Rava, mitlakeit mahu, mitroseis mahu, mitmasmeis mahu. So you have a number of situations or scenarios, and Ravina is posing questions to Rava, what happens if this situation or the case is like this? Mitlakeit means that there are small pieces of basar all over that add up to the rove, but it's not a singular entity of basar over there. Is that good enough to be considered that or basar chufim et rubo? Mitro says, as Rashi says, it is mirudad vikalush. It is flat and very thin. So you have an extremely flat and thin layer of basar on top. So even though, yes, it's affording the protection, you have the cover that you need, it's still not such a strong cover. So maybe that's not good enough. And then the last case is mitmasmes, which is something that we actually saw earlier. Hechi domi mitmasmes. What exactly is this mitmasmes? Some Ravuna braid Rav Yeshua, kosher rufe, kodro, anything that the doctor, the veterinarian, would cut away. So again, this is with the description that we had when we had the sugya back on Daf Nun Gimel. That means that when they want to heal something, they cut away the dead part, or they cut away the decomposed or deteriorating part, and then the live part's left. So the mitmasmes is that deteriorating, decomposing part of the skin and the flesh. So that's what we're speaking about over here. The question is, if it's still there, is it protective, and is it sufficient to be considered a cover over here? We had it earlier with regards to organs, that if that is decomposing, then we look at it as if it's not there. You take it away, and then if the aver with that taken away would have been a treifa, then it's deemed a treifa. So something that with the mashu would be a treifa, if you would take this away, it would make it into a treifa. Also over there, we spoke about that you cut off until you hit the live part of the organ or the live skin and flesh. That's what the doctors do in order to have it regrow. They cut away the part that is decomposing, the part that is deteriorated. So over here, Tosafot says, well, isn't that obvious? If we said earlier, back on Daf Nun Gimel, that we look at it as if it's not there, it's not there then, and you don't have the cover that you need. So why is there even a question here in the Gemara? So Tosafot says the difference is that back there we're speaking about organs, the item itself. When the item itself is missing something, then it doesn't exist, and it's a problem of a treifa. Over here, we're speaking about protection. Speaking about something that needs to be covered. So over here, even though technically we look at it as if it's not there, but physically there is a barrier above the bone. And maybe that's sufficient, even though it's decomposed, even though it's not healthy basar and healthy or, maybe the fact that the bone is covered is sufficient, and that's why it would be okay over here. Ivailu, nikev mahu. What about if there is a hole, meaning that the basar that is covering the area has a hole in it. So a puncture through to the bone. Nizdak mahu. What happens if it is cracked? Meaning that the basar that's sitting above it has a crack in it. Niklaf mahu. What happens if it peels away? Which means that it is on top, but it's not secure on the bone. You're able to lift it up, put it back down. The basar and the or are there, but they're not attached to the bone. They're not fixed on the bone, so they can be flipped up and down, they can be moved up and down. Is that sufficient? Nital shlisha tachton. If the lower third has been taken away, I mean it's covered over, the basar and the or are covered over, but underneath there's a space between that basar and or and the etzim, because the bottom third of the basar is now missing, so it's not directly in contact with the bone. So Rashi over here notes that the question was in an imtim salomar, which is, Niklaf me'al ha'etzem, which means that there's nothing missing, but it's still not attached to the bone. Im tim salomer, if you say that niklaf lo chiseron is okay, then the next question is, nital shlish ha'tachton. What happens if you're actually missing some of the basar, and that's why it's not attached? Then what's the din there? Tashma, let's at least try to answer some of them. The amar ulam rab yochanan, or harehu ke basar. The skin or the hide has the same din as basar. Over there it sounds like, even though the skin doesn't touch the bone itself, the skin is a sufficient cover for the bone. So that seems to show you that it doesn't need to be directly on the bone or directly attached to the bone, because we classify skin like basar. And clearly, there's always basar between the skin and the bone, and so if there's only skin there, and it's harei uke basar, that shows you that it doesn't need to be attached in order for it to be considered a cover. It says, Dilma, Dikano Mashcha Dide, which is Rashi's Girsa. On the other hand, the Bali Tosfo bring a Girsa from the Rabbeinu Hananel, which is that it's Rirei. And therefore you get the two possible explanations as to what it means over here. Either it's a case where the Mashcha means the skin or the hide. Kana, it has now attached itself, Dide, in that area. So what Rashi says over here is that there's certain parts of the bone where there is no flesh between the skin and the bone itself. In most places, you have flesh between the skin and the bone, but there are some places where it's very thin, and the skin is right up against the bone. So maybe when you sit over here, Aorke Basar, that's in a situation where the or is sitting directly on the bone, and it's attached to the bone. So maybe that's a situation where or works. Who says that or works even when it is separated away? The way that the Bali and Tosafot learn is that it's rirei, which means that it's got some sort of viscous, stringy attachments between the basar and the bone. It's something that has stickiness to it that shows that there's some sort of attachment that's growing there or attaching to it. It's an indication that there's healing going on, even though it may not be directly attached. So who says that in a case where it's completely detached from it, that would be okay, and therefore you don't have any proof that the fact that or is a sufficient cover, because it's a case where there's or directly on the bone, and therefore it's attached, and you can't prove anything from it. Or to the Bali Tosafot, the or ima basar might be a situation in which there is some sort of indication of healing or attachment between the bone and the basar. Over here, you're asking a case where it's flapping or the shlisha tachton's missing. Maybe over there, it's not classified as being covered. Amar Rav Ashi, Kavina Bei Rav Papi. When we were in the Beit Midrash of Rav Papi, Bailon, he asked us, Nikdar or Nikdad, Kamin Tabat, like a ring, Mahu. What is the din? So Rashi explains it over here, that around the area of the break, they cut out a ring externally, like it would look like a Tabat, in the area of that basar. So the or exists on the outside. The question is, will it now grow or heal because you've cut away basar? There's no attachment to the basar in the middle or to the basar that's being chufet, the shever. So in that instance, will we assume that the outer basar will continue to heal and seal up the hole? Is this a long-term viable solution by which the bone that is cracked will stay covered? That's the way that Rashi learns it. There is a Rashba brings a shita of the Rabbeinu Hananel that they actually carved not a hole in the basar, but rather they carved into the bone. There was a cut in the bone. So now you have this window or hole or tabat that is opened up. What is the din? Upashtana miha. And I answered from the following. Damar Rav Yehuda Marav. Davazesh alti lechachamim ulerufim. I asked this question to the chachamim and to the doctors, Ramru. And they told me, Misarto be'etzem umale aruka. If you scrape it, you cut it with a bone, then it will start to heal. It will show signs of healing. Aval parzalo, if you do with metal, mizra zarif. That is destructive in nature. And that type of cut actually inflames the area and causes it to deteriorate. His suggestion is that if you have this area that surrounds the emptiness, again, now we're still thinking about the basar on the outside, that flesh and basar, if you cut it with something that is not metallic in nature, then it causes some sort of bleeding and moisture that helps the basar to start growing, and therefore it will indicate that there is healing that's going on over there. On the other hand, if you do with metal, it only serves to inflame the area and cause it to be worse and not to heal itself. So what you're trying to do is to promote healing in the area. So that's what I answered. If you use an etzem and you cut it around and it creates sort of liquidy substance that exuded from the skin or the flesh over there, that's an indication that it's starting to heal and that it will promote the growth of the skin. And it will seal up the area. If you don't have that, then it won't seal up and it won't be a sufficient cover for this. If you think that it's the hole in the bone, then if you scrape on the bone, there's some sort of moisture or stuff that leaches from the bone that will seal up the hole. And that will then solve the problem of the hole in the bone. But again, you have to do it with a bone in order to do it, to scratch it, and not with metal. Because metal is too sharp, and is not efficacious in promoting healing, but rather just causes more problems and only serves to inflame or to hurt the injury that's already there. So you want to promote healing. So if you do it in one way, it'll promote healing. The other way, it actually will cause more problems. Amar Rav Papa, b'hu dekana garma didei. That's only true if, like we said before, that the etzem, the bone, is holding on to that which is around it. Meaning that the skin and the flesh that are around it are attached. If that's the case, then when you scrape it a little bit and cause it to have moisture and bleed a little bit, that will then start a healing process. But if the underlying basar and the or are not attached, are not really connected into the bone, then doing that's not really going to help because the skin that's there is independent of the bone and it's not going to then heal in that area or reattach to the bone to seal up the area. Or for the Balei Tosafot, again, that would mean also rirei, which means that if there's moisture, which indicates that it's actually healing and attaching to the bone, then you would suppose that it would continue to do so. But if there's no moisture in there, it's all dry and it's not attached to the bone, then we wouldn't assume that facilitating or triggering the healing process is going to do anything because the basar and the or are already starting to pull away from the bone and they won't seal up that area. All right, next Mishnah. Ashokheta beima, you shaft an animal, matzah bashtulya, and then you find inside of it a placenta. Nefesh ayafa tochlena, anybody who is not so particular can't eat it. Meaning if this type of thing doesn't bother you, then when you shaft the mother, it's nitar ayidei, the mother. We see it as being like anything else inside of the animal that is nitar yedei deshkeita. Ve'eino mitama lo tumat ochlim ve'lo tumat nevelot. But it is not negdar ke ochel, which means that most people wouldn't eat it. So the underlying assumption is that the placenta is like perish. It's like things that you would throw away when you shaft the animal. So unless someone has specific positive intent to eat it, we don't assume that it has tumat ochlim. In addition, it doesn't have a classification of basar. So if the animal died, we wouldn't assume that it is a nevela along with the animal. If you ate the placenta from a nevela, it wouldn't be like eating nevela. Now, it may not be a kosher to eat, but it won't be considered or classified as a nevela. So it's not basar, it's not ochel, but if you intend to eat it, then it does take on the character of being, or the possibility of accepting tumat ochlim, because you've now designated it as an ochel below tumat nevelot, but it never will have a din of tumat nevelot because it doesn't have a din of basar. It might, you can give it a shem ochel, but you can't change the fact that it's not basar. So its natural state is to be nothing, which is that it's not ochel, it's not basar, so therefore it's not a nevelot, it can't accept tumat ochlim. If you intend to eat it, then you can give it, you can makshiv it as an ochel, and therefore it'll accept tumat ochlim, but you don't change the fact that it's not basar. Shulya shiatzta miksata asura ba'achila. A placenta where a portion of it is exited from the animal, then you can't eat it anymore. We've discussed this earlier back on Daf Samachet. The problem is that there might be a birth over here, which is that many times the placenta means that there was also a birth of some sort, there was a fetus in here. And how do we know that in this placenta is not contained the rosh, the head of the baby or fetus that would have been there? And therefore you have a birth. And that birth then, as well as that which of the placenta remains inside of the behema, will not be permitted achila because it was outside of the mother at the time when there was shechita or it didn't have a shechita that was matirit. Siman vlad b'isha v'siman vlad b'behema. A placenta is an indication of birth by human beings. It's also an indication of birth by animals. Hamivakeret. You have an animal who's giving birth for the first time. So then the offspring would be a bechor if it was a zakar. Shepila shilya. That had a miscarriage of some sort that had a placenta that exited. Yashlichena leklavim. You can throw it out to the dogs. It doesn't have a din of kedusha. The Gemara will discuss why that is. But it is because the majority of possible outcomes over here would not result in something that is kadosh. Ube muktashim, that is not true when you have an animal that's kodesh, like a shlamim, where it's a female shlamim, and then there's a placenta that came out, tikaver, it has to be buried, because over there, the majority of outcomes will result in an item that is kadosh. Ve'en kovrim ota b'prashat derachim, you don't bury these placentas in the fork in the road. Ve'en tolim ota b'ilan, you don't hang them up on the trees. Both of those were meant to prevent further miscarriages in the future. Me'pnei darchei amuri, because that's following in the ways of the Amori, or Vichukotayim lo Teilechu. We'll discuss this at the end of the Gemara today, why that is, and what the problem is. How do we know that the Shilya, the placenta, is Nitar, Ayyidei Deshkita of the mother? The Tanu Rabbanan. Kol Be'ema Tocheilu, there are both et HaShilya, that you can eat any animal, to include the Shilya. Now the truth is that you don't really need a reboy for that, because that's something that's obvious. Anything that's inside of the animal, of course you can eat it. So the Chiddush is the fact that we don't consider it to be Eber Min HaChai, or maybe Basar HaMiduldal, and therefore the Shechita Zose Nipo, that we do consider it to be subsumed inside of the mother, and therefore the Shechita of the mother will be Matir this Shilya LaAchila. Yochol Afilu Yatzta Miksata. You would think even if a portion of it exited, Tamalomar Ota. Ota velo shilyata. It and not its placenta. Gemara says, Michte. Ein shilya below vlad. If a shilya comes out, it also comes out with some sort of fetus with it. Lomali kra. Then what do you need a pasuk to tell me this information? Meaning that if there is a fetus over here, then if the vlad came out and it's a birth or there's something that exited, then there's no way that the mother's shechita is going to help you over here once it's exited. It can only help you when it's inside. So what do you need a pasuk to tell me when the placenta is on the outside, you can't eat it? Well, if the placenta is an indication of birth, and now you have some sort of fetus that's on the outside, of course you can't eat it, because the only way you can eat it is if the shechita of the mother was matir. And it can only be matir if it's inside. So given that, what do I need a pasuk for? Where it says, kra asmachta ba'alma. The pasuk is just a hint at this, but you don't really need the limut. The main use for the pasuk, as Rashi says, is the Rosh Achrita Ato. The pasuk over there is coming for a different limud, which is the limudim that we bumped into a number of times early in the Masechta, including on Daf Samachtet, which is when you cut out internal organs of the mother, and then you shech the mother, that's not matir those organs. If you cut out the spleen of the kidneys, and leave them inside the mother, and then shech the mother, they are not nitar, yidei deshkita of the mother, because it's otah bishleimuta. Only when she is whole, is there a din of shechita being matir? But the shechita is not matir, things that are separated away from her. In distinction, or in contrast to the ubar, where even though it's a separate entity, or you cut it up, it still will be nitar, yidei deshkita of the mother. That's the gzerta ketubah, we call that is bibehema. Anything that's inside of the animal is nitar. The otah is a miut to tell you that's only true of these other items. It's not true of the animal itself. If you have detached organs, the shechita of the mother will not be matir them. Veinu mitama. It doesn't have tumat nevelot. Bai Rav Yitzchak bar Nafka. Or chamor shishalko. If you take the hide of a non-kosher animal, chamor, and then you cook it heavily, meaning that you boil it and you cook it heavily to soften it, mau. What is the din? Lamai. What exactly is the question that you're asking? Ila tumat ochlim, tanina. If you want to know whether it can accept tumat ochlim, we have a Tanakh source that already addresses that. Ila tumat nevelot. If you want to know if it has a din of a nevela now, tanina. We also have a Tanakh source for that. Tumat ochlim, the issue of tumat ochlim, the tanya. Ha'or, vashulya, emetamim tumat ochlim. When it comes to the hide, or the placenta, they don't have a din of tumat ochlim. That's partly what we saw in our Mishnah just now, that the shilya doesn't have a din of tumat ochlim. But, or shishalko vashilya shechishev aleha. On the other hand, if you have a hide that was cooked heavily, or a placenta where you had intent to eat it, then they are mitamim, tumat ochlim. So here you have it straight out. The or shishalko, when you cook up a hide, it changes it from something that before was not edible, into something now that is edible. If that's the case, then you've put it into the world of tumat ochlim. It has the possibility then of accepting tumat ochlim. So as far as that is concerned, the default status of the hide is that it's not mekabel tumat ochlim, and the placenta, in a similar but different fashion, does not have a din of ochlim until you actually consider it or are machshivit to be eaten. So both of these items don't have, by default, the status of tumat ochlim. But you can bring them into the world of tumat ochlim through boiling up the skin. And that's the question you ask. The answer is, of course, there is going to be tumat ochlim now because you softened up the skin. Now, the Baal Tosafot say, if that's the case, why can't you have somebody be nimna on a Pesach on the or on the skin of the Pesach? So Tosafot says, in the end, it has to be something that people would eat on a regular basis, not something they would eat if they were in desperation or eat in an unusual circumstance. that even with this heavy cooking, so yes, you brought it into the world of Ochlim when you boiled it up, because now it is edible, but it's still not edible in the sense that I would count that towards the Korban HaPesach and assume, okay, because I can cook it up, therefore, it's also included in the Basar of the Korban HaPesach. Because people in general will not eat this, or it's not a natural way to eat it. It does have Tumat Ochlim, but on the other hand, it's not something that is mainstream Ochel. And now, we also said that with regards to Nevelot, Tumat Nevelot, Nami Tanina, right? Tumat Nevelot, we also have a Braita, Bin Nivlata. Velo ba'or, velo ba'atzamot, velo b'gidim, velo ba'karnaim, velo ba'talfayim. This is an important braita, and the main sugya dealing with this is actually found in Avodah Zarah as well, which is that b'nivlata tells you that something is only a nevela when it is the basar of the nevela. But it does not include the or, the hide does not have a din of nevela, with the exception of the or, if it has a kazayit basar in it, then it would be. The atzamot, the bones don't have a din of nevela. The gidim, the sinews don't. Velo bikarnayim, not the horns. Velo talfayim, and not the hooves. So all of these parts of the animal do not have a din of nevela. So this opens up the question about the issues of things like gelatin, which is if they're made from the bones of non-kosher animals. Over here, the Braita tells us that that's not an issue of nevela. I mean, those items are not considered to be not kosher, quote-unquote, because they're not subsumed under the world of Nevela. So this is a braita that has big impact in terms of whether you can use items that are from non-kosher animals when it's not the basar of the non-kosher animal, what the implications of that are. And the fact that the braita has to come and tell us that they're not considered to be basar, you only need that if you made them into tzikei kedeira. That's where you boil them, heavily spice it and marinate it, to the point where you can eat it, even though the item may not naturally be something that you eat, but because of the addition of all the spices and all that's there, it becomes somewhat edible. A food item, because maybe over there you would have thought they were basar, and that's what the braita comes to dispel, that even in that situation they don't have a din of basar. And then the olam, our question over here is about Tumat Ochlim, not about Tumat Nevela. And the question is because even though regular ore, when you boil it up or you cook it up, does have a status of Tumat Ochlim because then it becomes edible, nevertheless, by the ore of a chamor, maybe the din should be different, the shiny ore chamor, demais. Because the ore of a chamor is ma'us, is disgusting. And since it's ma'us, maybe it's not classified as Tumat Ochlim, even though when you boil it with other hides, it does have a din of Tumat Ochlim. Over here, maybe it doesn't have a din of Tumat Ochlim because of the nature of the hide of a chamor. Shilya shiyatzta. You have a placenta that came out. Amar Rav Elazar, loshano el she'eini mavlad. That's only true if there's no fetus there. Aval yesh mavlad, if you look inside the mother and there is a fetus there, ein choshashim levlad acher. We don't worry about another vlad. So you have the placenta that came out, and then you have the blood that's found inside. So we're not going to assume then that the placenta that came out with a blood, and that what's inside is a different blood. We're going to assume that the two are connected, and therefore the placenta that exited was connected to the blood that's left inside the behema. That helps you vis-a-vis the fact that you don't have to worry about there being a birth over here. You don't have to worry about in the shilya itself that there is a fetus inside of it. So even though a minority of the shilya has gone out, and that is clearly a surah b'achila, because it wasn't nitari de shkita of the aim, that which remains inside is nitari de shkita of the aim, because we associate it with the vlad that's inside, and therefore that minority of the shilya is not considered to be a birth, and therefore that which remains inside, it is nitari de shkita of the aim. Unlike the case in our Mishnah, where there is no vlad, then the exit of a miut of the shilya makes the remainder that's inside also problematic. Because we assume in the miut that left that there was a birth there, and that drags the entire shilya along with it to say it's as if it's born, and therefore the shechita of the mother is no longer efficacious at being matir the shilya. We open our beni ima vlad, ben yesh ima vlad, whether there's another vlad internally in the mother or there's no vlad with it, hoshishin levlad acher. We do worry about another vlad, and given that you can't eat it because of the fact that it is possible that there was another vlad internal to this placenta. So, is that really the case? Va'amar irimi al-chumra, amra rabbalazar. that Rabbi Elazar's position was the Chumrah, meaning he was more Machmir than Rabbi Yochanan. The way we have it now, he's Mekil, and Rabbi Yochanan is the Machmir. Rabbi Elazar is saying that when you have the fetus that's found inside the mother, we don't worry about the Shilya anymore, and we assume the two are associated with each other and don't assume that there's another Vlad inside of this Shilya. On the other hand, Rabbi Yochanan is saying, we do worry about there possibly being another Vlad, and therefore you can't eat the Shilya because of the fact that there was possibly a Vlad that was associated with it. Ella itimar hafe itimar. If you're going to say this, remember, in the name of Rabbi Elazar, this is the way it should be. Amar Rabbi Elazar, Oshanu ela she'ina keshura bevlad. That's only true if it wasn't attached to the Vlad. Avakshura bevlad, in chushushim the Vlad acher. If it's still attached to the Vlad, then we don't worry about anything else. So what Rabbi Elazar proposes over here is that if there's the umbilical cord that's connected between that Vlad and the placenta, then we can assume that the placenta is connected to the Vlad and that there's no other Vlad that's involved over here. On the other hand, if there is nothing attaching the Vlad to the placenta, then we would be choshesh, we would entertain the possibility that the placenta belonged to a different Vlad, and the Vlad itself that's inside had a different placenta. And we're actually missing some quote-unquote information here, but there's a Vlad that went out independent of the Vlad that's inside of the mother. Rabbi Yochanan Amar, Anu ein lanu ela shilya below Vlad. We only have the situation of a shilya without a Vlad. That's in a case where we're choshesh for a Vlad. Avayeshima Vlad, if there is a fetus there, ben kshura b'Vlad, whether it's attached to the Vlad, ben inkshur b'Vlad, whether it's detached from the Vlad, ein choshesheim l'Vlad acher. We don't worry about the possibility that there is another Vlad there. V'hainu dama Rabbi Yirmiya l'chumra, amra Rabbi Elazar. Now I understand Rabbi Yirmiya's statement that Rabbi Elazar is the chumra, because Rabbi Elazar is only matir the situation in which the placenta is attached to the Vlad. Otherwise, he says that we are choshesh, whereas Rabbi Yochanan says we're never choshesh. As long as there's a Vlad there, the assumption is the placenta is connected to that Vlad, unless you have evidence to the contrary. Tanya kavate de Rabbi Elazar. We have a braita that supports Rabbi Elazar's contention. Hamapelet min beima chaya ba'of. A woman that miscarries a fetus that has the shape of an animal or a bird. And the reason, as Tosafot says, it picked this scenario that miscarried a beima chaya ba'of is because if she miscarried something of a human form, then any time within the 3 days, we would associate the placenta with the fetus, and therefore there is no decision to be made here as to whether the fetus and the placenta are connected together. The shilya imaem, and they have a placenta with them. Bizman shikshurabem ein choshin levad acher. When they're attached, then we don't worry about another vlad. Ein akashurabem, if they're not attached, if they're detached, or any matila chomer shnei vladot, then I give it the chumrah as if there were two births over here. Shani Omer, because I say the possibility is here, Shema Nimach Shfir Shel Shilya, maybe what was the fetus then dissolved into the placenta, and then Shema Nimocha Shilyoto Shel Shfir, and the Vlad, or whatever was born here, this Behema Kayof, that its placenta dissolved. So that what happened here is that you have a fetus that is a misshaped or misformed fetus. When it exits, we don't assume that the placenta necessarily belonged to it. We assume it had its own placenta and that might have dissolved or went somewhere. And the placenta that exited was associated with a different fetus, but that fetus dissolved or something after that fetus and we don't see it. So we view them as being two entities unless they are attached. If they're attached, then we assume that they are a single entity. And if you remember, there's a machlok between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim, Hamapelet min beima chaya ba'of, whether it's considered to be a birth or not. According to Rabbi Meir, it is a birth. According to the Chachamim, there is no birth over here. And depending who you think this is following, will then influence your interpretation of what the Braita is saying and how it's a proof to Rabbi Elazar. So Rashi explains, we are choshesh for the Shnei Chumrot, which means that we assume that either it is a birth, and if it is a birth, we have to choshesh that it was a nekeva. And for a nekeva, the woman is tmeah for 2 weeks. So she has 14 days of Tumah. But if it was an Ekeva, not only would you have 14 days of Tumah, you'd have 66 days after that of Tohar. But we're choshesh that maybe there was no birth over here. And if there's no birth over here, you get no Yemei Tara and no Yemei Tumah. So we take the Chumrot of both of them. We assume that there is a birth. That would have been the other placenta that came out. We'll assume it's an Ekeva, and then you have to keep 2 weeks of Tumah. The other hand, we can't give you the days of Tara, because the possibility is that there wasn't another birth, and the only birth was this misformed fetus, and that misformed fetus does not make you Tamei Tumat Leida, because it doesn't have the shape of a human. And this is according to the sheet of the Chachamim, that if you miscarry a Min Behema Chayavov, that the woman's not Tmeya Tumat Leida. And in that case, you have no Tuma, no Tara. So we give you the Chumrah of both. 2 weeks of Tuma, no days of Tara. That's the way that Rashi reads it. So Tosfot over here says that's the way Rashi explains it, that it's following the sheet of the Chachamim, that such a birth is not a real birth. But he says, from the Lashon of the Gemara, sounds like we're speaking about it as Rabbi Meir. Because Rabbi Meir believes that a Behema Chayin Oath is considered to be a birth for Leida, and does generate Tumat Leida. And therefore, there is two Vladot over here, and that's what the meaning of Shnei Chumrot over here. So in a situation where the miscarried Behema is a Zachar, then you only get 40 days, because that, for sure we know, was born over here was a Zachar. So you only get 7 days of Tumah plus 33 days of Tara. But the possibility that the other placenta indicated a birth of Nekeva, so we're going to force you to keep 2 weeks of Tumah because of the Chashash of Nekeva, but we won't give you more than total of 40 days, so that means you only get 26 days of Tara instead of 33 days of Tara because of that Chashash, and that's Shtei HaChumrot. But then Tosfot says, in the end, how is this a proof to Rabbi Elazar's position? Because we're bringing over here is the fact that the woman miscarried a Behema Chayavov. And Tosafot said in the previous Tosafot, the reason they brought Behema Chayavov is because had it been a Nephil, a fetus that was miscarried over here, over there we would assume that since that is a natural way of birth, that the placenta is connected to the Nephil, to the miscarried fetus. And even if the fetus comes out 3 days later or the placenta comes out 3 days later, we associate them with each other. So that means that the only reason over here that you need it to be kshura is because of the fact that this is an unusual type of birth. Because it's an unusual type of birth, in order to connect between the placenta and the fetus, you need it to be attached. If it's detached, then we don't assume that. But implied in that is that in a normal birth, then you wouldn't have this requirement of it being attached. And actually, it would turn out that the Braita is not a proof to Rabbi Elazar. It actually goes against Rabbi Elazar's opinion. Because it's saying the only time you need kshura is in this unusual birth, not in a case of a normal birth. So then Tosafot says, V'yesh lomar, that the real reason over here has not to do whether this is a normal type of birth or not. Elav shita le the mesader shas, etzurat adam talu yatam. It has to do with what type of form comes out. So that when it is something that has the form of a human being, then the shilyata will hang out. It's common for a human-like fetus that comes out, or even a regular birth of a human being, that the placenta tarries inside of the womb and only comes out at a later time. But when you have a behema chayavov, then it doesn't matter whether it's inside a woman, it doesn't matter if it's inside of an animal, the assumption is that the placenta comes out simultaneously. So the difference over here doesn't have to do with whether this is a normal or not normal birth, it has to do with the realities of the fact that things that look like human beings that are miscarried or born, generally the placenta takes more time to come out. Items that look like a behema chayavov, whether it's inside of a woman or inside of a behema, the placenta normally comes out at the same time. And therefore, over here, the reason that's a proof to Rabbi Elazar is because when it comes to behema chayavov, we expect the placenta to come out immediately. And if it's attached, then we consider it to be one. If it's not attached, we don't consider it to be one. And not because it's behema chayav oath. That's not the reason why it has to be in this case. Versus a case if it was something that looked like a human being, but rather the distinction is that behema chayav oath, we have expectations that placenta will come immediately. And even though it came immediately over here, we still say that if it's attached, then it's considered to be one. If it's not, then we're choshesh for two births. If that's the case, it's supportive of Rav Elazar's contention. Gemara continues and says, Hamavakeret Shepila. In a case where the animal is having its firstborn and has a miscarriage that has a placenta that comes out, you're allowed to throw it to the dogs. My daima. Why is it in Kadosh Bikdushat Bechorah? Amaravika Braid Rabami Robemot Yodot Dabar Kadosh Bibikorah. Most behemot, when they give birth to something that's Kadosh Bibikorah. Umiut behemot. There's a minority of animals that give birth to something, Davar Shenu Kadosh B'Bechorah, that does not qualify to have Kedushat Bechora, Umaynihu, what is the item that they're giving birth to that's not qualified to be Kadosh Kedushat Bechora? Nidmeh, something that looks like another animal. They're giving birth to a offspring that does not look like themselves. For instance, a goat is giving birth to something that looks like a sheep, or vice versa. That case of Nidmeh, they don't attain Kedushat Bechora. Now, Bechola Yoldot, Yoldot Mechsa Zecharim Umechsa Nechevot. So now, the normal birthing process involves a 50-50 chance that you have a male or a female. So a female is obviously not Kadosh B'Kedushat Bechora. The male would be Kadosh B'Kedushat Bechora. Given that, it's 50-50 chance that which comes out is classified as something Kadosh or not Kadosh. So this placenta that came out, 50% chance it was a Zakar, 50% chance it's an Ikeba. Misafek, we should have buried it and not thrown it out to the dogs. The reason we don't say that is because there's an additional minority of animals that are not Kadosh, even if they are Zicharim. Even if it gives birth to a Zakar, sometimes the Zakar is not Kadosh when it is a Nidmeh. So even if you give birth to a Zakar, there's a possibility that even that Zakar won't be Kadosh if it looks like a different animal. Now, if you take Samich, Miuta, the Nidmeh, if you take the minority of animals that are Nidmeh, that don't have Kedushat Bechora, even if they are Zakar, Lamechsa, then it came out, and you add that to the 50% of offspring that are female, Babalu Zakharim Miuta, then the chance of having a Zakhar that's Kadosh Bechora is a minority possibility. And given that, ala rov, it won't have Kedushat Bechora. Because of that, you can throw it to the dogs. You don't have to worry about the Kedushah of the Bechor. Bechor, 50-50 chance that it's a Bechor in any given regular birth because of male-female. And then in addition to that, even on a male birth, there are times where they would not be Kadosh because of Nidmeh. If I add those together, the female 50% and the percentage that are Nidmeh, I'm over the rov line. That means rov, or whatever is born over here, does not have Kedushat Bechor. Then we said about Kodoshim. Umukdashim tikaver. By the cases of things that are kadosh, that are like shlamim, that belong to Hekdesh, there you have to bury it. Mai taima, ruba bar mikdashu. The majority of them are something that is subject to kedusha. Now that's because both a zachar and a nekeva in this case are kadosh. An offspring of something that's Hekdesh is Hekdesh irrespective of whether it's a male or a female. So that means it doesn't matter which gender is born, it's going to be kadosh. There is a minority that are not kadosh, which is the case of Nidmeh. The majority are kadosh, so you have to deal with it like it is kadosh, and that's why you have to bury it, even though there is a minority that are not kadosh, that which is the Nidmeh. And here Tosfot asks, is it really true that a Nidmeh is not kadosh? Because we have a Gemara in Temura that indicates that it seems to be that a Nidmeh is kadosh, b'kedushat bechora. So he says that it's a machloket ha-sugyot, as to when a bechor becomes kadosh. There's a machloket as to whether before becomes kadosh v'me'imo, in utero, or is before becomes kadosh v'havyatan, when they are born. So Tosafot says, if you believe that they become kadosh v'me'iman, then even a nidmeh would have kedushat bechora, because it's kadosh from the moment it's conceived, irrespective of what it is in the end. And for that reason, that sugya in Temura believes that the bechor is kadosh, even if it is a nidmeh. Our sugya over here believes that the kedushat bechora only devolves v'havyatan when it's born. And says over here, when it was born, it was a nidmeh, that's already, quote-unquote, a mum, and therefore, it doesn't have kedushat bechora. That's one way Tosafot deals with it. Or he says, inami, even according to the one who says that b'me'iman kadosh, there still are instances where that which was found in the animal will not be kadosh. For instance, if it's a demutziona, if you find something that has the shape of a bird inside of the animal, even the one who says that there's kedushat b'me'iman from the point of conception, he would agree that that's not kadosh. So there are instances where whatever is nidmeh, that's not the regular animal, comes out, it would not be kadosh. And that would then take down the 50% of zecharim that would be kadosh b'kedushat bechora and drops it below 50%, making the nekeva plus whatever minority that is, the majority of cases, and that's why it's not kadosh b'kedushat bechora. So there are two different ways that Tosafot deals with it, either to say it's a machloket ha-sugyot, or to say, even according to the one who says that, v'me'iman kadoshim, over here there still are exceptions to the rule. Nidmeh, yes, would be kadosh, but there's certain nidmeh, like the yonah, or demud yonah, that would not be kadosh, b'dushat bechora. You add that to the 50% of nekevot, you have a majority that are not kadosh. Vein kovrim otah, you're not allowed to bury it in the fork in the road, or hang it up on the tree. Bai v'rov v'damrei tarayu, kol devar sheyesh bo refuah, anything that has a medicinal use for it, ein bo mishum darchei amori, doesn't have a problem of darchei amori. Ein bo rufua, if it doesn't have medicinal efficacy to it, yesh bo mishum darchei amori, then you have a problem of darchei amori. Rashi over here says, yesh bo mishum rufua, what does that mean, that it's medicinally efficacious? Kagon, mashke, osam, some sort of drink or potion, olakash, shalochei shalamake, or some sort of incantation that you say over the wound that will help it. The main sugi of this is actually found in the Gemara in Shabbat. And over there, Rashi makes another statement, which is, it has to be something that is a rufa nikeret. It has to be an obvious and clear medicinal purpose. So it has to be something where it's, whatever you're doing, is clear that it's medically driven, and that people know about this type of medical cure, or the fact that this is efficacious. So Rashi has a higher standard than simply that it is effective. It has to be obviously effective, which means that other people would recognize what you're doing as being medicinal in nature, rather than something that's darchei amori. Now, in contrasting that, that means that darchei amori are things that you do that have no purpose. It's not clear that darchei amori are necessarily associated with avodah zarah. It might be that there is some correlation between them, but even if they're not avodah zarah, it's still problematic, because it's following in the ways, or acting like emori, where there's no rationale or logic behind what the individual is doing. And when you do that, all you're doing is being middameh. You're just acting and trying to emulate the behaviors of the other nations, which have no purpose and have no meaning. In that context, you're in violation of darchei amori. But if there's some rationale for what you're doing, which here is medicinal in nature, then we don't worry about darchei amori, because it's obvious why you're doing it. There's a rationale. There's a logic behind why you're doing this, because you want to cure yourself. So again, if it's not a practice of avodah zarah, then it's not an issue to use it. If it was a practice of avodah zarah, even if it was medicinal in nature, it could be problematic, because you ain't mitrapim b'avodah zarah. You're not allowed to cure yourself with avodah zarah. It's one of the three cardinal sins. One has to give up their life to not worship or not be engaged in avodah zarah. So if it was an avodah zarah practice, it'd clearly be problematic. Here, it doesn't have any obvious avodah zarah practice associated with it. We might be choshesh that maybe it originated from something in avodah zarah, but basically it's a practice without meaning, and many of the Rishonim classify it as being something like nichush mkishuf. It's things that are soothsaying, witchcraft, sorcery, that type of behavior which has no rationale, and it's not real, along the lines of voodoo, and therefore you can't use it. The Rashba, on the other hand, says, unlike Rashi, it does not have to be something that is clearly medicinal in nature. It just has to be something that has medicinal purpose to it. And if it works medicinally, even though people don't know about it, it's not obvious to them, that's fine. So that's a lower threshold if it make it not darchei amori, according to the Rashba. That has nafkamina, we'll see in a minute. Batanyo, don't we have a bright the lunch meshir perutav? There is a tree that's dropping its fruit. It grows fruit, but then it drops them all, and they don't make it to maturity, and they never can produce fruit. So grove is sikra. You paint it with some sort of red paint, bitoano ba'avanim, and then you put heavy stones towards the base of the trunk and on the roots. Bishlamo toano ba'avanim, I understand why you put these heavy rocks by the roots of the base of the tree, ke'eche de nichush chulei, in order to weaken its strength. As Rashi notes over here, the belief was, the reason that it's dropping its fruits is mirov shomno, because it's so fat, it's got so much juice in it, it's so strong that it just drops the fruits, it can't hold on to them because it's just pushing out everything from inside of it, it doesn't allow it to hold on to anything. So if you put weight on the base of the tree and you make it work harder at the base or on the roots, that will take away that strength and then the fruits won't fall off. It's a rational reason that you would do this based on what you think is the problem with the tree, and therefore it's not considered to be darchei amori. Elo sokro v'sikra amai. Why are you allowed to paint it with this red paint? What is that doing for you? So according to Rashi, there's no obvious medical benefit from that. According to the Rashba, it's not medicinal at all. So then, why is it that you're allowed to do this? Gemara says, k'heche delitchazio inche v'liboy rach me ilavei. Its purpose is not medicinal in nature, but it does have a purpose. The purpose is to make people aware of the fact that this tree has this problem, And when they see the paint on the tree, it'll remind them to daven for the tree so the tree should stop dropping its fruit. So it's a way to indicate, to flag the tree as being problematic so that people take note of it and they'll daven for it. So it's like putting up a billboard on the tree and saying, daven for me. So that's why you're allowed to paint it. So again, for the Rashba, it doesn't have a medicinal purpose, but it has purpose, and that's enough. And according to Rashi, again, it may not have obvious medicinal purpose, but it has an obvious reason, which is that you're painting it because people should know, and they will know, now that the tree is problematic. So there's an obvious reason for doing such a thing. Kedetanya, like we have by the Breita, Tamei Tamei Yikra, by the Mitzora, he has to call out to people before they approach him and say, I am Tamei, I am Tamei. Tzarech Lodi al Rabim. The reason he has to do that is to make it public. For anybody that passes him knows that he's Tamei. In order that the public will then daven for him or daven for a cure for this individual. So it's good to make other people aware of the problem so they can daven on your behalf and bring you a Yeshua. And so too, the Bitsora is not just Tamei Tamei Yikra to keep you away so you don't become Tamei. Tamei Tamei Yikra is an indication that I need help. It's a call for help and the person needs to respond by davening. And similar over here, painting the tree is no different than Tamei Tamei Yikra. It's an advertisement that there's something wrong over here. And this is, has broader application. Mishi Yira Bo Davar. Any person that has some sort of issue, problem, difficulty that befalls them, Tzarich Lo Di'al Rabim. You should make it public. You should make people aware of it. Rabim Mevakshim Alav Rachamim. So that other people can daven on your behalf and beseech Hashem so that it solves the problem. Of stories, other weary places in Shas, that Rava used to, at first when he fell ill, would not tell anybody, but after a certain amount of time had passed, like 3 days, he would then make it known to the Rabbim so that people could then daven on his behalf or intercede on his behalf. So there is a balance between making everything public, too much information. We don't need to know about all the details and every little thing that's going on in your life. On the other hand, is if something is persistently problematic, then you want people to know about it so they can daven and help you out and daven on your behalf. Amar Ravina, keman talinan kufsa bedikla. Like whom do we hang the fruits, the dates of the palm tree on the palm tree? Keman ki haitano. Like the tano that just spoke about the tree that's dropping its fruits, that you put stones on the bottom and you paint it. So the siman by a palm tree that it's dropping its fruits is to hang the dates on the palm tree so people know that it's dropping its fruits. And so it's not Darche Amori because there's a purpose to it. It's a billboard. It's a sign to the people to take note that there's a problem with this tree and they should daven on behalf of the tree. And so that is like this Tana. Now, this does lead to a lot of literature. And again, the main sugya is in Shabbat, Ev Mekorot, that I will share with you with regards to non-traditional medicinal cures and homeopathic medicines, as well as things like Lachashot, incantations, kmiot, and amulets. What are the considerations halachically with all these items? Do we allow you to do it? Or are these considered to be darche ha'emuri? So the Rashba has a number of tshuvot on this issue where he is very makyo with regards to this. And the main thrust of what he is saying is really driven against the position of the Rambam. The Rambam is basing it on the Gemara in Shabbat, which says that if we know that this lachash works, or we know that this amulet or this writer of amulets has a proven track record, then those aren't considered to be darchei amori. But that means that the Rambam limits it and narrows the scope of what is permitted to those types of things where there's a proven track record, which means that people have already identified this, and the quote-unquote chachmei hateva agree that this is a valuable solution, or we have evidence of the fact that it is a valuable solution. So here in his criticism of the Rambam, where he quotes him, and he says, "Vani shuel k'mistapek b'divrei Ramzal," and I question the view of the Rambam over here. "Ma'u adavar shi'akru Ramzal shigzru iyuna TV." How does the Rambam know, or what does he classify as something that is accepted as being part of nature and is something that makes sense within the natural world that it will cure it? Is it based on people who have written books about nature or about medicines, like Aristotle and Galen, V'chavreihem shibichru sfarim b'teva samim, that they wrote about different medicines, v'amisa'adim v'amoylim lifi yunam, that which helps based on their investigations and their experiments, v'chol mashal esig yunam hu b'chlal yisur darchei amori, and based on that, then the Rambam is going to say anything that's not in those books is considered to be darchei amori. He says, it doesn't make sense to me. V'etzu yun chachamim elu yifsak me'efsharut ayuna tivi. Who says that the capacity of nature and medicines to work is limited to what they see? That doesn't make any sense. Those things that work biskula are not doing any magic or voodoo over here. It is natural and it works. It's just we don't know or we don't understand yet how it works. But there are things like that that do work. And therefore, Ritzoni Damar, Teva lo yishigenu iyuna chachamim. That is, that there's some things that the chachamim won't get to, or they won't understand. And therefore, the Rashba is much broader in what he's willing to accept over here. He says, as long as this is a practice that possibly has medical benefit to it, or is a possible thing that will work, we're not going to push it away and declare it as darchei amori. And he sees this as part of your fiduciary duty of rapo yirape. Umisha hisigo choli. Eino sumeichal anez. Shalo lishol birofim. Uli tasek bidvarim hamoilim. Ben bidvarim hativim. Ben biskulot. You have to use everything at your disposal. Whether it means doctors. Whether it means homeopathic medicines. Natural cures. Or skulot. You have to take every opportunity. And that's what the Torah commands you. Rapo yirape. Only things that are obviously done on an irrational basis, or things that are practices without any consideration of the rationale behind them, in that situation, that the kishuv and the nichush, that we will not do. And the Rashba goes on to say that we would limit that to the things that the Chachamim mentioned. Like here in the Mishnah, where they're burying the fetus at the fork in the road, hanging the fetus from the tree. Or in the Tosefta and Shabbat, and the Gemara and Shabbat, has lists and lists of items that are classified as being Darchei Ha'emuri. Those things are considered to be Darchei Amori, but we don't come up with things. And if someone's doing something that looks like it shouldn't work, but there's a possibility that it works, that's not Darchei Amori, because they're doing it for medicinal purposes. They're doing it for something that works Derech HaTeva, and therefore it is okay to do it and not subject to Darchei Amori. Including over here, he speaks about the possibility, based on what he has in the Sefer from his Rebbe, the Ramban, of having an image of a lion being put up and drawn specifically for the choleh, that somehow helps the choleh. And he says, we don't know how it works, and we don't understand it, but there's no reason to believe that it's darchei amori, if it's something that the chachamim have told us will work in this case. And even though you can't understand it, and even though it's not something that necessarily is logical, nevertheless, these are the way that teva works. It's beyond our comprehension many times. And there are possibilities of things working, and therefore he's matir, or much broader in his swath of what he's willing to be matir. In addition, there's a huge tshuva from Rav Avadya Yosef that discusses again about these homeopathic and other types of skulot that people do, and the ability of one to use them on Shabbat in cases of pikuach nefesh. Can you violate the Shabbat for pikuach nefesh with one of these items? And there the Avadya Yosef says, if it's something that has a proven track record, then according to someone like the Rashba, it might be permissible to write an amulet on Shabbat itself because of the Bikuach Nefesh and the track record of this individual of curing these things, so nothing is omit b'fnei Bikuach Nefesh. On the other hand, if it's more speculative in nature, there's no proven track record that this works medicinally, whether it's an amulet or whether it's any other type of medicine, then we would not necessarily violate the Shabbat midoraita in order to provide such a cure. Midei Rabbanan, there may be more latitude to deal with that. Okay, with that, we end the fourth perek. Hadron Alach, Ve'ema, Mekasha.